עוד שם תבקשי משאלה ואני אבקש חזרה ואם אתה שומע את קולי בחלום אני לא אוותר עליך והימים עוברים והלילות קשים הלב מדמה והנפש שלי כבר
Bienvenidos al episodio 6 de la temporada 4 de Goy Friendly. Este episodio va a ser completamente en inglés porque nos visita Sohail Ahmed, un ciudadano británico, activista a favor de una versión del Islam más liberal, más secular, con una historia muy interesante. Él es de una familia de origen pakistaní, en un hogar musulmán, que cuando llega a la edad de 6 años es captada o se adhiere a una versión radical del Islam y desde esa experiencia, desde esa crianza, él va desarrollando el deseo de ser un mártir, un shahid, y ese deseo va volviéndose cada vez más fuerte, conviviendo además con otro dato de su historia que es bastante duro para su experiencia de vida y lo que le tocó, que es descubrir que era gay, en un marco donde eso era penado con la muerte. Todas esas cuestiones van apareciendo a lo largo de una charla muy rica en anécdotas, en experiencias realmente llenas de conflicto y que nos muestran a una persona con una sensibilidad muy particular, pero además con un conocimiento muy profundo de lo que habla y por qué propone lo que propone. ¿Qué otras cosas nos va a compartir Sohail Apu?
Sohail nos va a compartir un mensaje esperanzador y es importante escuchar a los que como él pudieron salir del islamismo. Sin más, arrancamos.
Hi everybody, this is episode number 6 of our 4th season. It's going to be completely in English because we have a special guest. Apu, my friend, is going to introduce him, but I would like just to give some context. We are finishing the month of April. Israel defended from Iran's attack, or the Islamic Republic of Iran's attack. We're still away from the doomsday episode, but we don't know what's going to happen. So we keep engaging in conversations that we believe are going to help on our way to, I don't know if peace, but at least mutual understanding. And one of the things that is really complicating most of the conversations and the mutual understanding is what do we in the Western world understand about Islam and mostly about Islamism, which is completely different. One thing is the religion. The other thing is the political project that spins off the religion, which looks for the installment or deployment of the Sharia, which is the Islamic rule in all the countries that the Islam can infiltrate or expand or whatever. We would like to see that as something that happens in a reality. So the more we get to speak with people that have an experience that were born in Islam and then left Islam or that converted to Islam but reject Islamism and would love to live a life under the Islam philosophy or religion, but willing to accept the existence of Israel and the existence of Jews and actually becoming a voice against anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, which we came to understand are the same thing, well, the better. So, Apu, would you like to introduce Mr. Sohail Ahmed to our conversation?
Sure. So we have here with us Sohail Ahmed. He was born in London of Pakistani parents. They are from the Kashmir region of Pakistan. And he told in other interviews I've heard that his parents were originally considering religion, Islam, like being good people, which is something that many of us in the non-religious Judaism can completely relate to. But then when he was 6 years old or so, they became entangled with Salafism, the Wahhabi practice that came from Saudi Arabia, and told him that there's a war going on between Islam and the rest of the world. Great Britain is a enemy territory, that he is first and foremost a Muslim and not British, and that violent jihad is his obligation. And he tells about this like being in a sect. So welcome, Sohail. Please help us unpack this story of yours.
Thank you ever so much for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure and it's a complete honor. So thank you to both of you for having me on. Regarding my story, everything you said was absolutely perfectly correct. I was born in London, born and raised. I'm still living in London, in fact. And my parents came from Pakistan, both of them. My dad came here when he was about 3 years old, and my mother came here to get married to my dad. And originally, I had a very normal childhood, normal-ish, if I can say, but it wasn't extreme in the religious sense. I was taught that to be a Muslim means to be a good person, and that's what I was raised with. Sometimes we prayed, and you know, that was it, really. Enter my sixth year of age or thereabouts. Again, I can't fully remember. It's been such a long time ago, but it was thereabouts six, seven, around about that age, maybe even five. And
how old are you now?
I am now 32 years old. Yes. So first, the changes, I didn't like them at all as a child. I didn't fully understand what was happening at first. But what had happened is that my parents had gone to visit another family in the same tower block we lived in. The other family, they were from Mauritius origin, right? And they introduced them to Salafism, or to as other people refer to it, as Wahhabism. In terms of those two terms, Salafism is what Salafis refer to themselves as. Wahhabism is what other Muslims refer to them as. And Wahhabism is seen as somewhat pejorative as a term, a negative term. And yeah, my parents first, their physical appearance changed. Music wasn't allowed. My mom started wearing the headscarf first, then the hijab. So just kind of like covering the hair first, headscarf, then the hijab fully with the full kind of covering of the head and the body. Then started wearing the niqab, so starting to cover the face, but with the eyes visible. And for a short time, she even covered the eyes as well. But then she kind of reversed that and went back to covering the face but having the eyes visible. After that, my mother started even covering up her hands and her feet. So it got to that level. And I, as a child, kind of looking back at it, now I can look at it and say, maybe this isn't the best thing for women, right? You're kind of erasing them from society. But if someone is really, really for it, then I'm a bit agnostic on whether we should legislate against it or not. So I'm agnostic on that. I haven't made up my mind. As for the hijab, I don't have an issue with, right? That's just my personal view. And my dad started kind of growing a progressively longer beard. And these changes are just cosmetic, by the way. These aren't worrisome on the whole, right? These are just cosmetic outer changes. But what then transpired, or what followed, was that I was then exposed to the ideology. So then there's a never-ending war between the kuffar, the non-Muslims, and the Muslims. One day we are all going to rise up and fight jihad against the kuffar, the non-Muslims. Or rather, the better translation of kuffar is infidel. It's a very pejorative term. And it was, you know, one day when the scholars say the time is right, we are going to rise up and we are going to, in Britain, by the way, we are going to rise up and fight jihad. Jihad is an obligation on every single Muslim. When I say jihad, I'm referring to not jihad of nafs, not the jihad of the inner heart. I'm referring to violent jihad, the external jihad, the major jihad. And I remember as a six-year-old believing and wanting, and I only realized afterwards that this was really messed up, because to me, this was just the norm. I grew up with it.
So, Hail, now that you mentioned that this was normal for you by the age of six, how did you relate to your English buddies or friends or at school? What was, I mean, because it's like a, it's really explosive, kind of like you're going to fight your friends, which are infidels.
See, that's the thing. I was taught at home to hate the kuffar in your heart, but to be outwardly nice to them, outwardly, so that they convert to Islam.
You were allowed to kind of like become a marketing agent for Islam?
Exactly.
Or it was more like a taqiyya thing that you had to lie and,
yes,
and look nice to protect yourself or something like that?
Indeed, to convert other people. And as a child, I knew this was wrong. I had lots of non-Muslim friends. And my parents said, no, the kuffar, they will not love you. They will not care for you. They will not be your friends. They pretend to be your friends, but they're not really your friends. But I was looking around and thinking, my infidel friends, they really care about me. They really want to be my friend because they want to be my friend. And as a child, I knew this. And this was kind of my first ever doubt about my religious ideology or my belief system. I pushed it to the back of my mind because I couldn't tell my parents, because if I ever asked a question about Islam, they would just slap you, right? It's like they don't have the answer, so they just slap you, right?
It is an answer. It's a way of answering.
It's an answer. Indeed.
No more questions, for sure.
No more questions. And yeah, I was raised with this, and I knew that that was wrong. It felt wrong. Yeah, that answers that question. And as a six-year-old, I wanted to die a shaheed. Shaheed is martyr in Arabic. I wanted to die in war as a six-year-old boy. Let that sink in. That's not a normal childhood to want to die.
No, I mean, we're used as a Jewish and a Zionist to receive pictures of small kids being, I don't know if harassed is the term, but being grabbed by Hamas and getting them to pose with a Sinwar in a picture holding guns, and we saw kind of like actings in kindergarten or school where they act like shahids and they have to kill IDF soldiers. But this is something different. This actually doesn't come from an insurgent or a liberation movement. This is something different. This is like really religious. So you have no political, you know, upper side on the moral struggle. It's just we have to wipe them because they are infidels. There's nothing like social justice, nothing in between. It's just, I would say, how do you deprogram? How you started to deprogram? It happened during your childhood, or you grew up feeling like you had to be a Jahid?
I grew up feeling like I had to be a Shaheed. So the extremism got to such an extent. And by the way, I realized when I was 8 that I was gay as well, right? So imagine being a gay extremist, right? Like I'm literally believe in jihad and like fighting the kuffar, and I'm gay. So I was literally a gay jihadist, as insane as that sounds. And I'm not the only one who has been through this experience, by the way. And to this day, I remember exactly that moment when in the mosque, they said the punishment for homosexuality in Islam, or in that version of Islam, the Salafi Islam, is to either execute them, throw them off a high place like a roof or a mountain, or to throw them off the roof or a mountain, then to stone them to death. And I remember thinking,
just in case you survive the fall.
just to be on the safe side, you know, just to make sure they're dead.
So let me ask you one thing, because this is really mind-blowing, because you realize at a young age that you felt attraction for people of the same sex, something that is not forbidden, it's really dangerous for yourself, and you still carried on kind of like hiding that and somehow camouflaging it with the jihadist impromptu and the willing to take it to the next level, maybe.
Precisely what happened. So what happened, in fact, is that when I grew older and I became a teenager, I started looking at fatwa. Fatwa means legal edict. So in the West, we think of fatwa as like being a death sentence. That's not always the case. Most fatwas are about religious rulings, like how to pray and that sort of thing. Most of them are boring. And I looked at fatwa that were written by the Saudi scholars, the Salafi scholars, on how to deal with the issue of homosexuality. Now, someone had anonymously asked the scholars this question. I am dealing with this same sex of attraction affliction. That's how they see it, as like a disease. what do I do to fix this? There were many solutions that they gave, you know, solutions. And one of them was to either marry a girl, right? Ruining not only your life, but her life, poor woman, right? Thankfully, I did not do that. Or it was to become more religious and to become more devout. And I chose the religious and devout option because that was only the real option available to me. I did actually say to my parents at one stage, I want to get married to a girl. And they said, no, they said, you're too young. I was about, 17 years old then. The fatwas said that going back in time, so before 17, the fatwas were basically saying that you should become more religious. And given that my form of Islam was very extreme to begin with, it meant in practice becoming more extreme. So I became even more radicalized as a direct consequence of me being gay, as insane as that sounds. Now, when I'm a teenager, I've finished school. I am now in college, not in university. In college in the UK is pre-university, the 2 years before university. It's like the last 2 years of high school in the US. And I had increased freedom. I felt like I could make my own decisions now, right? I could go out whenever I wanted to. Not whenever, but whenever I wanted to. I became very angry at the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars, which I had been very angry about before. In this context, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were in their drawdown stages. By the way, every single mosque I attended, so all of these are Salafi mosques. This is in the UK, in London. Every single imam in the sermons, in the lectures, all the time, they were saying this is a war against Islam. The US and the UK going into Iraq and Afghanistan. This is an extension of the never-ending war against Islam. See, we told you, we were right. They are only going there just to kill Muslims. That's it. There's no other reason.
Now that you mentioned that, I'm a big fan of music. During that time, during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, I just started to look for music from all over the world. And I came, I just found a Asian Dub Foundation. It's like a, some sort of hip hop and really like a furious and angry anti-West and almost like it's like jihadi hip hop, something that you might find in France. There are some sort of like banlieue rap and hip hop too. For me, it was like a surprise because it was like the same message as you would expect to have in a mosque, like you're telling, but aim for youth with music that there's not supposed to listen to music. It's like if you're really religious, you're not into music. But for me, it was always a mystery how the message spread out in liberal countries. So in your case, it was basically kind of like you had a feeling, you felt that it was impossible for you to make it happen and live according to what you felt. So you go full religious. You didn't have to be celibate, right? It's not like you have a monastery or something.
No.
You still could get married and become a imam, yes, or something like that. But what happened then? Did at some point that collide or you just plan to kill someone?
Yes. So and this is always very, very hard for me to say. And by the way, I go up and down the country in the UK. I attend universities. I tell my story. I give my opinion. I speak alongside victims of terrorism. So one of my friends, he was a victim of the London Bridge attack. Another one was a victim. He was in charge of a pub when one of the terror attacks happened. And both of his managers were on the ground, stabbed, bleeding. And he was the oldest person, 18 years old, only 18. He became the manager and was in charge of looking after everyone in the pub during a terror attack. So I give talks alongside these friends of mine. I give talks alongside experts in extremism, de-radicalization, and in terrorism. And it's never easy saying this. But at one point, I began seriously considering engaging in a violent attack in London. And the fact that I even began to consider it, thankfully, I did not do anything. I did not plan anything. I did have like a target in mind, but I didn't do any surveillance. I didn't write anything down. I did not access any bomb making manuals or anything. So thankfully, I did not break the law. This was only in the remit or the confines of my mind. But the very fact that I even began to seriously consider it, doing something so horrific and horrible, I always wonder, what does that say about me as a person? Am I evil? Am I inherently broken? And this is something that I contend with every day. I often cannot sleep at night thinking about what could have happened. In the beginning, when I first de-radicalized and I left home, I would wake up in a sweat, screaming in nightmares of me actually doing something horrible. And I would wake up screaming, oh my God, I've done it. And then I'd realize it was just a dream. So this was very, I say this with very deep regret and very deep kind of shame. But I seriously began engaging in an act of violence in London. And for that, I will never forgive myself. I'll take the guilt of that to the grave. And thankfully, I managed to pull myself back from the brink because something inside me said, no, this is wrong. See, prior to that, 9/11 happened. And I remember my parents celebrating. Yes, they celebrated. They said, see, the Kuffar kill us. Now we are killing them. Then 7/7 happened after that, right? The attacks in London. And that's when I began to think, oh my God, these are the people in my city. These are the people I walk past when I go to school. It could have been any of my friends that was caught up in this attack. That put in the seeds for terrorism is wrong, violence is wrong. But again, I pushed it to the back of my mind. I said, no, this is my religious belief. I have to believe in it. So when I began to consider this horrible thing that I was considering, I began thinking back to how I felt when I saw 7/7. And I thought, this is wrong. I can't do this. It doesn't matter what you believe in. I'm agnostic, but I thank God that I did not do anything, that I had that internal moral compass in me to desist from that, to stop myself from doing that and from doing anything horrific. Now, I looked for interpretations within Salafism itself that said terrorism is wrong. And I came across the strongest argument, which was this. And it does not say that terrorism is wrong because you kill innocent people. It does not say that it is morally abhorrent. No. It says rather that as a British citizen or a citizen of a Western country, you in effect have a covenant or a legal agreement with that government saying that you will not attack that country. You will abide by the law. So on this very technical legalistic reason, I said, okay, I'm not going to do anything. Now, that's problematic because if you have a very technical legalistic argument, especially when it comes to religion, there's ways around it, right? Now, Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the first US, I think the only US, I'm not sure if he's the only, but was the first US citizen to be killed by US drone strike. He was an Al-Qaeda operative, and he used to preach at my mosque for a short while. He wasn't part of Al-Qaeda at the time when he was preaching at the mosque. The mosque was extreme, but not that extreme. And he basically said, actually, this argument does not apply, because if you are born a British citizen or an American citizen, you did not sign anything. It was forced on you. Therefore, that argument does not apply. That legal agreement does not apply to you. Therefore, you should engage in a terror attack. Do you see what we're contending with? This is deeply troubling and dangerous. But thankfully, I stopped myself. And that's when the doubt started coming in, started questioning things. I started seeing the hypocrisy. They would attack Jews. They would attack Judaism. But when anyone criticized Islam, even with a genuine criticism, right, they weren't meaning to be bigoted. I could tell. They were just criticizing Islam because they disagreed with something. We would scream Islamophobia. You're a bigot. You're a racist. And I would think, wait, we're doing this to other people. Yet when it happens to us, we cry. Isn't this hypocrisy? And then I started looking at the opinions on slavery in Islam. And I thought, oh my God, this slavery does not, I do not support slavery. And then there's sexual slavery. Then it's like you're allowed to rape the slaves. They don't consider it rape, but it's rape. And I thought, I cannot support this. And slowly I began to question things. I began to kind of question Islam altogether. But then one day my doubts became so bad, I was severely depressed. I thought I was going to burn in hell for having all these doubts. And I decided, okay, I need to confirm whether my beliefs are true or not. How can I do that? Okay, what's something that I can externally validate outside of religion? Science, scientific facts I can validate by looking at the evidence. I knew how the scientific method worked, right? So then I looked at evolution, biological evolution, as in the origins of humanity. And Salafi Islam says, nope, if you believe in evolution, you are a kafir. You are no longer within the fold of Islam. Not all Muslims believe this. In fact, there's a growing trend within Muslims to accept evolution. And I then looked at evolution. I looked at the arguments for and against. Immediately, I realized evolution is a fact. It's true. We all originate from the single common ancestor. At this point, I was dealt with a number of options. One was to stop believing in Islam altogether. The other was to ignore what I had just learned and just believe blindly. The other option was to look at my religious belief system, question it, and change to another version of Islam. And I chose the latter, the last one of all of those. And I began considering everything about literally Sharia, chopping off people's heads because they had sex outside of marriage. I questioned everything from the idea of establishing a caliphate and offensive jihad, which, by the way, they believed in, right? Like, they believed that we are going to establish an Islamic state. We are going to engage in offensive jihad to expand the borders of this state, to take over other lands and then bring them into the Islamic state, right? Annex them. And I thought, we were arguing, we say the West is evil for going into Afghanistan because the Taliban defended or protected Osama bin Laden. Yet we are believing that we should take over the entire world by offensive jihad. Hypocrisy, right? And
at least you would expect the West to react if this is actually a master plan, which I find really shocking, because mainly if you say something like that in the West, you're accused of being Islamophobic.
Yes.
Which is basically having an irrational fear towards, yes, Islam. But there are reasons to be afraid of, not of Islam, but of Islamism.
Of Islamism, of the ideology that I was raised with.
And it's really rational, because someone that comes from that experience, from an experience like yours, telling whomever wants to hear, look, this is happening. This is my background. I can tell you. This is my life experience. And they will tell you, no, you're a self-hating Muslim. It's like,
yes.
It's really tough, I think, because it's like mostly the Westerners now that we're seeing the students in the campuses in the United States that are going to tell you what you're actually thinking of your own life experience, right?
Indeed.
So I wanted to go back to your comment, Santi, about the radicalization, and that you, Sohail, you all also mentioned it. I picked up three key concepts here. One, knowing the people you're supposed to hate. You said a couple of times that you had friends in school, they were nice to you, and that some passersby that you meet in your way to school might be attacked. So that's number one, knowing the person you're supposed to hate, that helps reducing the hate. Number two, what I hear from you is bringing the consequences of that war home. You said that having the terror attack in July 7th was like a wake-up call for you, because, okay, this is not something that is happening over there on the other side of the world. This is actually can happen here. Then there's this other thing that keeps coming up, that is the homosexuality, and I would say in general the control of the body by the preachers. I don't want to say the religion, because there's people executing what they consider is the religion. So I follow several ex-Muslims, or Muslims, or cultural Muslims, you may say, and many of them say the same, that being gay in a society that oppresses them made them find a way to radicalize, but it also at some point made them go the other way. Like, yes. If there is, maybe after emigrating, it's not your case, but there's this guy from Yemen I follow, and after moving to Sweden, he was able to see that there's nothing bad, there's nothing wrong with him, and that he should not just put so much pressure on his chest. And that opened the door for de-radicalization. And at the same time, I see that many of the clerics in Iran and in many countries, Talibans are often found in same-sex relations, which are supposed to be forbidden. And it also happened with the Catholic Church, where the clergy oftentimes, it's not the sin, but the scandal. So they covered up. So what is the role of the homophobia and the, in general, the control of the body by the religion in the radicalization and Islamism? What's your take on that?
That's a very, very good question, because when I was an Islamist, I knew a number of Islamists who, looking back, they were definitely gay. And I think what happens is that some of them go through a similar process that I went through, which is that they try to kind of become more religious. It's like a knee-jerk reaction where you're trying your best to try to keep this thing which you believe you must believe in. And as a consequence of you kind of almost inherently contradicting that thing, you kind of knee-jerk react and you go even deeper into that thing. It's like when, for instance, Muslims in the West often are more extreme than Muslims in the Islamic world. It's like they kind of leave the Islamic world, especially in the UK, this happens, and they kind of are surrounded by non-Muslims, and they then turn inwards. They ghettoize in their own areas. They turn inwards, and they become even stronger or kind of go even deeper into the bad parts of that thing, of that religious faith. That's a very big issue. I also saw that in many cases it de-radicalizes people because they realize, actually, you know what? They're all telling me that I can change, but I know deep down inside I cannot change, right? Interestingly, in my case, when my de-radicalization journey, my sexuality was the last thing I changed my mind on, the very last thing. First, I changed my mind on women's rights. I changed my mind on jihad. I changed my mind on all of these different things. The very last thing I looked at was my sexuality.
You still consider it to be a sin until the last...
Until the very last moment, I considered it to be a sin. Until the very last moment, that is the last thing I changed my mind on.
Now that you bring that, can you share with us the moment that you started to enjoy your sexual discovery, or you just said, okay, I'm going to be free and live it freely? And if it was a problem for you, if you had to sever ties with your family, or if you actually have to move to another city because your life was in danger, how was it like?
Funnily enough, I was sexually active even as a jihadi.
That's a book. You have a full book to write about that.
It's a movie. I'm already writing it.
Honestly, it was like I had two lives. At one point, I was going out with guys. And on the other hand, I was very Islamic and I was very religious. And people thought I was this very, like, respectable kind of religious figure, almost. And it was like living two lives.
But you were not afraid that somebody would blow your cover?
100%, all the time, every single time. I was
terrified.
I was on edge the whole time. And I think a few moments, my cover did get blown almost. And yes, so then only when I accepted myself as gay did I become a lot calmer, a little more happy in myself, right? Interestingly, I would engage in relations with guys, but I would never have a relationship. Because for me to have a relationship meant I am making a long-term decision to accept this, which I couldn't do believing in that ideology, right? Now, unfortunately, in Islam generally, not only in Islamism, but in Islam generally, it's very kind of anti-homosexuality. It's very homophobic. And I think there are small signs of change, but it's going to be a very slow process. And yeah, that's kind of how I de-radicalized. So it was understanding evolution that kind of led to like the domino schooling. One after another, all these doubts I had to deal with them. I became fully de-radicalized. One day, my anger boiled over at home. My parents would say very strange things. As you can see, I am now a liberal Muslim. At that moment in time, I was living at home. I'm a liberal Muslim, and my parents are saying these horrid things. I would have arguments with them. One day, my anger boiled over to the point, and I said, you know what? I'm not even sure if Allah exists anymore. Immediately, my dad said, get the F out of the house.
So that was worse than telling them that you were gay?
That came after. They realized I was gay. They realized I was gay when I left home, and they looked at my... see, this is the thing. I would delete my internet history. But they would, my dad is good with computers. He looked at the router itself and accessed the logs from that. So the physical logs. And then they were like, okay, we know this secret you've been holding. Come back home. For some bizarre reason, I came back home. I had nowhere else to go, really. So I came back home. And they said, the only way we are going to agree for you to stay in this home is if you agree for exorcisms to happen, to get the demons out of you, right? The jinn.
The jeans, yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
Right? Is there an actual process for that? Like, there are ceremonies?
There are. There's a whole process. I had to bathe in holy water, like things with leaves in it. They recite the Quran over me. They make me eat holy honey. At one point, they even suggested we can beat the jinn out of you. That's when I put my foot down and I said, no, you're not gonna do that, right?
Don't mean to be disrespectful, but it doesn't sound like a bathing with leaves and Quran recitement, like the worst conversion therapy that there is.
It's not the worst conversion therapy. It isn't. It could be much worse.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, psychologically, and this is bizarre because I've never felt like this before. My rational brain knew I was not possessed. I knew there was no such thing as demons. I was not possessed. There's nothing wrong with me. But somehow my animalistic brain, like my older mammalian and then reptilian brain, kind of went, what if you are possessed? What if there is something wrong with you? I was in the moment, and I've never felt like this before, where my rational brain thinks one thing and my emotional brain completely contradicts it. Yes, that happens to a degree, but not like this. This never happened before. And unfortunately, at that point, I became even suicidal. And thankfully, my dad walked in while I was preparing for this to end my life. And he said to me one thing that I will give him credit for, which is this: no matter what you do, don't kill yourself. And the day after that, I left home. And I haven't spoken to them since.
Are they still Salafist? And do you
from what I hear, they may even be worse. They believe that, yes, we should establish an Islamic state, and we should engage in offensive jihad to expand this state. So it's full on kind of business.
Do you have siblings? Are they in the same stage that your parents?
Well, I'm the eldest of the siblings, and it seems that all, if not most, of my siblings believe in that. Unfortunately, they haven't changed.
I wanted to touch upon a couple of topics. First, you mentioned the domino effect, and one of the pieces that you mentioned in another interview that fell was this identity, national identity part, that you were taught to consider yourself Muslim and to consider the country you were born in and citizen of, which is Great Britain, enemy territory. So now you, in your Twitter account, you have, I pledge my allegiance to king and country and humanity. So that's the first topic. Why do you think that is important to say out loud?
I think that's very important to say out loud because, look, you cannot argue for multiculturalism. You cannot support immigration if you do not support integration. And when I say integration, I mean you fully are loyal to the country you live in. You fully pledge your allegiance to that country, and that if there's a war, you will even fight against the country of your origin to defend your country that you have now taken as your home. That is the only way in which multiculturalism can work, in my view. And in terms of my view on Britain, It's very interesting, as this de-radicalization process happened, I began to slightly feel a bit more British every time, every day, to the point that, see, with Islam, it's very identitarian. People don't realize this. It's not just a religious faith. It's also almost like a political entity, like a polity. Like they used to be Christendom in the days of old, during the Crusades and stuff. There is the concept of the Ummah, the Islamic Ummah, or the Islamic collective. And
the Brotherhood is a way of putting it.
Indeed,
the Ummah, the Brotherhood.
The Ummah, indeed. It's almost like a separate country that does not exist, but it's treated as one, right? That's important to note. Now, I began to slowly feel more and more British, and I was a very strange person. I used to watch Parliament, right? I used to watch the proceedings in Parliament. And I remember one day, this non-Muslim, obviously most of the MPs are non-Muslim, right? It's Britain. And he stood up and he said, what are we doing to help ex-Islamic country who was going through a natural disaster at the time? And I thought to myself, if they really hated us, why would they be helping us? And that's when slowly I began to start feeling more British. And in the end, I kind of replaced that very strong identitarian mindset that I had with Islam. I replaced it with a very strong British identity. Because at the end of the day, people need to be part of something bigger than themselves. It's a part of the human condition. You need something that people will bring people together, right? Something that's meaningful. And I think it should be based on the modern nation state, but also humanity as like a general human thing, which is why I say I pledge allegiance to king, country, and humanity.
Now that you bring this idea about people needing to be part of something, one would say that all this woke radical left revolution, at least in their minds, is a revolution. It's mainly because the West is not offering political parties or religion or something to relate to them. And every generation feels the world is wrong and needs to be changed, which, I mean, as a Jew, I can relate to that, because even the most secular like ourselves pledge to this idea of tikkun olam, which is fix the world, at least a small part of it. It's in your hands, so you can do it. It's not like the world is perfect. But this idea that you have like 21 years old, and you and your brother are going to change it through radicalism in a campus pledging for the destruction of Israel, it's definitely not good. I was listening to you and said, okay, so if someone like Sohail with his story can move back or this move forward and leave that behind, leave family behind, which is really strong, do you think there's hope for these young spoiled brats in the United States campuses, or we're lost and the West is lost and then the Ummah is going to make that big caliphate happen?
I think there's hope, but the only way we can have that hope, and America does this a bit better than what Britain does. Now, America is a very, very strange situation because they have the extreme left and then they are also at the same time very right wing as well. So it's very, there's a polarization happening. So they are very proud to be American. I'm not sure about the extreme left, but most people in America tend to be very proud to be American, right? In Britain, we are ashamed to be British. We are ashamed. We don't fly the flag because of our colonial history. We feel like we are, you know, we the concept of white guilt, essentially. And because of that, imagine you are born into a Pakistani family or to an Arab family or to any other kind of like immigrant background. And you are British, on your passport you are at least, and there is no British community for you to be part of because everyone's ashamed to be British. There's no community. You will go to what is closest to you and what will replace that. In the case of a Muslim who's born in a Pakistani background or an Arab background or whatever it might be, the thing that is Islamism, which then says, yes, there's a very big polity, there's a whole group and this is your community and you're going to fight jihad and you're going to win, it seems very attractive because it gives you meaning, purpose. You're part of something bigger. This is why it is very dangerous to completely get rid of national identity, to completely get rid of patriotism. Now, nationalism, in its most extreme forms, we know historically is a bad thing. It can lead to horrible things. But to throw the baby out with the bathwater, to take away the entire concept or the idea, that's dangerous. Because when a country does not believe in itself, when the people living in a country do not identify as a collective, when they do not have like a goal in mind, then that country ceases to be a country.
If we have values, abstract values like freedom, free markets, and consequences for your act because you are subject to the law, maybe it's not enough.
It's not,
because
no.
you have no purpose. And I remember asking myself, why do the Brits pledge allegiance to the Queen? What does the Queen stand for? I mean, the Queen is the body for all that. I mean, I was born and raised in a democracy. It's been working more or less like stuff happens in South America. And we don't need a queen we have democracy. So that's like the holiest value.
We have the soccer team.
Yeah. Too. But you know, soccer, it's really strong because it's the only stuff that makes everybody together. And at the same time, someone from the right, from a right wing or left wing, they all shout goal every time Maradona or Messi scores. And that's it. The rest of the stuff makes us like divided. But when you don't have like a national identity and you have a strong enemy inside the territory with a very specific agenda, how do you remain hopeful? Because you say you have hope.
So the way in which I have hope on this is because I think that the pendulum, so Hegel came up, the philosopher, I think he was German, he came up with the idea of the pendulum swinging one way, then the other. So first people go to one extreme, then it swings back, goes to the other extreme. But then eventually it kind of settles in the middle. Currently in Britain, we are on the anti-patriotism, anti-nationalism extreme, right? We hate ourselves. We are not proud to be British. We don't have that. But when you go too far in that extreme, there's always going to be a pushback, like with Newtonian physics, right? Yeah. There's going to be a pushback. And I think that maybe initially it might go too much into the other extreme, but eventually it will settle down in the middle. And I strongly believe that people are beginning to realize what is happening. And I want to be a part of this movement, this change. Otherwise, I wouldn't do the work I do. If I didn't believe that change was possible, might as well give up. Just khalas, just call it end of the day, right? But I strongly believe change is possible. And even one person can change. Now, I don't think I'm going to be that one person. But even if I can, you know, encourage one person who will then eventually change the society, I think I'll be happy. Change is possible. Change is always possible. Change is not the minority. It happens all the time. We always have the mistake of thinking in our historical period, things are always going to stay the same. They never do.
While your work is focused on changing people that might be radicalized, our work here is to show that not all Muslims are or ought to be radicals, that there are people on the other side that we can talk with. And I wanted to touch upon the Jews part because, well, I assume that you don't have to repeat what you were indoctrinated in. I assume that. But spoiler alert, the other day in Passover, you uploaded a picture with a yarmulke, a kippah.
Yes.
Because you were invited to
a I still seder. Have it with me, actually. Yeah. I was wearing it like this. There we go.
Beautiful. yeah. And you said that you were invited to
yes.
share the Islamic view on Musa, our Moshe, Moses. And I wanted to know two things. One, what was the first time you encountered a Jew? And two, what was that you shared about Musa?
So I'll answer the first question first. And this is actually quite a wholesome story, thankfully, in my kind of series of unfortunate events that is my life. I remember my parents were doing business with another family, and we had to go to their home to give them the product. So we were selling them a computer. It was an old computer that they wanted and we wanted to get rid of. And I remember we went in. They weren't visibly Jewish, but I think the man was wearing the kippah. And basically, I went in there with my dad, and the child immediately ran up to me and happily was babbling and gave me his toy. The mother said, he wants to play with you. And then I said, is it okay for me to play with him? So then I sat down, I took the car, and I started playing with the toy, and he was so happy. He was like laughing, smiling, and I was laughing and smiling. There's this little child, children are precious, and he's playing with me and I'm playing with him. And I remember looking over to the parents. They were hugging and they were looking in happiness at both of us. And I remember thinking to myself, I hate them, but they don't hate me. And that's when my views on Jews started to change. I was still quite anti-Israel. So I was around, when this happened, I must have been around 15, right? So I was still very extreme. I was very anti-Israel. But slowly I began to become a lot more soft towards Jews. And eventually, it's that experience that when I de-radicalized, I became quite pro-Israel at the end of the day as well.
The anti-Israel standpoint that the Muslim community has in general, in your opinion, it's based on Jew hatred or anti-Semitism for what you're saying, because if that is the core, if that changed and that started to shift your position, I don't know, can you confirm? Or
it's quite complicated when it comes to the Muslim community and Jews. So there's the deep rot of anti-Semitism is there. Like if you look at the hadith referring to the end of time when Isa or Jesus will come and will fight against Dajjal, the Antichrist. It said that the Jews will hide behind the trees and the stones, and the trees and the stones will cry out, kill him, there's a Jew behind me. That's deeply problematic. That's deeply anti-Semitic. So the anti-Semitism is there. And in Islam, we were taught that, you know, the Jews were the most horrible people, and that's why this happened and that happened and blah, 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 blah. And it's very, very problematic. And a lot of it isn't just anti-Semitism. A lot of it is genuinely because as Muslims, it is drilled into us, unfortunately, that we will not give an inch of land to the non-Muslims. It's kind of like this superiority complex. We think we are better than others. And in that thinking we are superior and better, of course we're not going to give away an inch of land, even if there's a good argument for it, even if it's justified. That is why when it comes to Israel, it's like, no, Al-Aqsa is there, the Holy Land is there, it is ours. The Prophet Muhammad said, it is ours, it's ours. And this goes into Hadith and the problems with Hadith, which I won't get into now, but it's deeply problematic. It comes from this superiority complex. It comes from anti-Semitism, but it also comes from genuine politically believing in this concept of the Ummah and essentially saying, no, we are one collective and we are going to fight for our land. And that's where the division between Islamist and Muslim, it's not clear cut. It's kind of on a spectrum. And where you draw that line is somewhat arbitrary. And I think that's another point I think isn't mentioned at all in this debate.
The Israeli Einat Wilf always says what you're saying. They always told us the truth in our face. We just could not understand it, that Dhimmis, second-class citizens, should not have sovereignty because that is abhorrent, that Jews that are second-class persons still in the Abrahamic faith, so not completely the worst kind possible, but still it's second-class citizen. What are you talking about sovereignty over any piece of land?
And how does Musa or Moses fit into that narrative? Because it's a prophet, I understand, inside the Islamic mosaic or whatever you want to call it, like the pantheon or the staff of important people. What's the story on Moses, Musa, from Islam?
I say that Muslims can be quite anti-Semitic, but fortunately, there are also the ingredients for peace, for understanding between our people. Because Musa, alayhi salam, he is seen as one of the highest prophets in Islam. He's referred to as Kalimullah, the one who spoke directly to Allah, to God. That is an honor that is bestowed upon very, very few prophets. Very few. I think there's only like three or something. I may be incorrect there. The Prophet Muhammad is one of them. So he's Kalimullah. And what the Jewish people went through and what the Quran recounts of them escaping from Pharaoh, which is what we were, the Passover is a celebration of them escaping from the Fir'aun or the Pharaoh. And I refer to that and I said that this is horrid, what they went through, the killing of the firstborns, of the sons, keeping the daughters. Yes, so the ingredients are there for like understanding between our people. But the way in which the preachers say it is that they say, see, look, the Jews, they were being difficult. They worshipped a cow instead. They did this and they did that and they were very rebellious. And it's kind of turned into this very whole anti-Jewish kind of hatred kind of thing. Even though they are supposed to be people of the book, we unfortunately in the Muslim community hate Jews more than we hate Christians. I think that's very obvious.
So Moses is cool, but the Jewish people are not.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. His people are being difficult and rebellious. So,
yeah, he was so cool at the people. That's how it works.
The idea that they push forward, and it's very deeply problematic. It's very deeply problematic.
It's when like when they try to make Jesus a Palestine fellow.
Yes, indeed.
This guy is okay. The rest of you, out.
Because the Quran even refers to the Jewish people moving to the land of Israel. It's like it's mentioned, but it's like, no, now the Muslims have control over it. And because we are the rightful religion and we have superseded the Jews, therefore we should take it. It's very tribalistic. I remember one of my friends, he said he was in Israel with a friend of his and they spoke to an Arab. And the Arab said, I'm okay with speaking to you in Hebrew now, but if there was a terror attack or if there was a war, I would kill you right now. And they said, okay, what do you think of the Jews that support the Palestinians? He said, we will kill them too, because first, they betrayed their own people. Secondly, they are not to be trusted. They are still Jewish. They think deeply tribalistically. Instead of thinking of the common good or what is right, they think in their tribal, very deeply racist, very deeply in-group kind of way. It's very troubling, very problematic. And if we live in a globalized world where there's immigration and people are moving around, we cannot have an ideology like that. It runs counter to the entire globalization project.
When was the first time you saw and had a conversation with an Israeli?
When I de-radicalized and I started doing counter-extremism work, suddenly a lot of Israelis and Jewish people, they started paying attention and they started following me. Because obviously, counter-extremism touches upon Israeli security and Jewish security. Understandably so, rightly so. It's of course it does. And that's when I started speaking with Israelis and I realized I want Britain to be like the way Israel is. Because they are proud to be Israeli. They have a very strong identity and they will defend themselves. I don't want Britain to be exactly the same. Obviously, I have criticisms of Israel too. Of course, right? Like I'm not biased, but there's a lot of things that I can look at within Israel and I see actually a lot of things that the world can learn from. And that's my view.
I have a question for you, Sohail, related to the story that you portrayed. All this radical version of Islam came from Saudi Arabia, which is a country that now, a couple of weeks ago, helped Israel to defend itself, which makes me think that maybe the Wahhabi or Salafist, whatever you want to say about that flavor of Islam, is no longer available. And now the extremism comes from the Shia, and the source of extremism comes from the Islamic Republic of Iran. But I think it's not enough. At some point, I think the same way they did funding extremist mosques and clerics, they have to start funding more liberal clerics and and to help fix the problems they created several decades ago. Do you think that could be a solution? Because I mean, from a Jewish / Zionist point of view, we have no place, no other place to go. Even if we are in the diaspora, we are still related to Israel. We're going to fight until we die. But we are 16 million. I mean, we're an easy target. We have to make alliances. And this conversation, even though it's just for the sake of having a conversation, and maybe we toss it to the sea like a message in a bottle, whoever wants to pick it up, it's not going to make a large-scale change. I think large-scale change can come from power centers like the Emirates, Saudi Arabia itself. Do you think something like that needs to be demanded from the Muslim liberals, not just telling their own story, just kind of like start organizing be a little loud towards the more yes. rational Islamic countries?
See, there's multiple points I would like to make there. So firstly, Islamism doesn't just come from Iran and Saudi Arabia. We can look at Salafism and we can look at the extreme Shias, but it would be a mistake to just focus on Salafism. So whilst my story is from Salafism, and that's what I lived through, there are other forms of Islamism. So there's the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Ikhwanis, the Brotherhood. There's the Deobandis in India. There are other forms of Islam and versions that could be classified as Islamist too. But in terms of what Saudi Arabia is doing, now Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, he's been pushing through a number of changes within Saudi Arabia, trying to liberalize it. Now, of course, he also ordered the killing of the journalist. I can't remember his name.
Kigashi.
Yeah, yes, yes. And he ordered his killing, which is horrific and utterly wrong. And I think the US has every right to kind of put its foot down and say that's screwed up. But at the same time, he is also, on one hand, he's trying to push for change. But I think what he's thinking, and I can't speak to what he's thinking, but I can only hypothesize, is that people will push back against him. And the only way he can retain control is with an iron fist. And unfortunately, because of the way in which the Arab culture works, they almost kind of respect the iron fist kind of rulers. It's why there are so many dictators and things in the Arab world. The way they think and their culture is different. So they respect power and iron fist and kind of like almost violence at the same time. So that's kind of what he's doing. But at the same time, what he did with the journalist and the other things he's doing is not justifiable. And I will criticize him as well as support his successes, what he's trying to do.
So at some point, we might have reforms and possibility. I mean, not as a journalist to raise your voice, because it looks like it could end in a bad way. But I mean, I understand there's a trade-off between reforming too much and losing the grip on society, especially yeah. when they come from societies that can actually breed barbaric people. I mean, I think a terrorist is a barbarian with access to technology. I mean, that makes sense to just move forward with reforms and at the same time trying to get a grip. And religion is still a powerful grip.
If you want to heal the world and make it a better place, you quote Hegel, I quote Macartney, you need to fund reform mosques, reform organizations, de-radicalization organizations. Enough with funding Jewish voices for peace who end up making alliances with the Islamists.
I would like personally to thank you for all the stuff that you shared. It was really powerful. It's really hard for me to be on your shoes and imagine what you had to go through, and still not being able to touch base with your family and let them know you're alive. And I mean, I would really love for that to at some point change and let all the hearts involved in this tragedy be healed. It's one thing what happens in the world, and the other thing what happens in your own personal story. And it's really hard to move along through life without family. And that's my wish, and something that I really want to finish our conversation without saying it. So I'll leave it up to Apu to do the final question.
Yeah, before doing the question or the comment, I just wanted to say from human to human, you're a good person.
Thank you.
What you are doing, I know you feel tortured still by what you thought you may be doing, but what you're doing is 1,000 times bigger than what you almost did, okay? So I wanted to thank you at a personal level.
Thank you for saying that. That's really deeply touching.
And my last question, I follow a lot of former Muslims, and I think most of them, until very recently, like 1 year ago or 6 months ago, still carried their Atavic prejudices against Israel. And I feel like since October 7th, that is starting to change. Is my view correct?
You're absolutely correct. I've noticed that too. And I've thought about this, and I've discussed this with other people before. I think the reason why they are still quite anti-Israel is because they are desperately trying to show the Muslim community, see, we're not completely changed. We still agree only with you on some things. It's kind of like they're trying to claw back some of that rejection that they receive. And in so doing, they become blind sometimes to the reality of the situation. Now, it takes something like 7 October to happen in order to undo a lot of that. And when they saw that happening, and I was like, what am I telling you? This is what we're dealing with. This is what Hamas is. They only realized that when that happened. And it's very sad that it took 7 October and for hundreds of Jews to be murdered for them to realize that. And that's just deeply sad. But at the same time, it's understandable when you understand the human dynamic behind it and the kind of the need to want to be part of a group and not to be rejected. Because everyone's anti-Israel, right? It's easy to just be like, oh, you know, the majority, they must be right. Everyone's anti-Israel, they must be correct. But obviously, the reality is a lot more complicated. And Israel is dealing with almost a hopeless security situation. I mean, the Israeli people have been living under continuous attack from missile attacks from the Gaza Strip. Of course, if you are continuously living and you see the Iron Dome, you know, destroying the missiles that could have killed your family, of course you're going to become more right-wing. Of course you're going to vote for people that are promising you security above all else. And that's what's happened. That's what led to the destruction of the left in Israel. And it's very understandable. I say this as someone who stands, generally speaking, on the left, center-left, more center, center to center-left. And it's understandable. You can't look at it and go, oh, they had no reason. It's entirely understandable, again, through the human dynamic and the way humans work. And you're absolutely correct, and you're on the dot with that. I've noticed that too.
So I hope we see you next year in Jerusalem.
Hopefully.
I hope we visit, right?
I would love to.
I'd like you to go. And we want to thank you so much for being here. And we leave the line open for continuing this conversation in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you, for having me on. It's a complete pleasure and an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, too. And let's keep on with more conversations like this.
Brilliant.